years ago, in the biblical land of Babel, there flowered the first great civilization. At its heart stood the ancient city of Babylon. Today, thousands of years later, that civilization lives on. While Babylon may have fallen 60 miles to the north, its modern-day successor still attracts visitors and academics from all over the world seeking to uncover its secrets.
Because the world wants to have assurances that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
President's office. No, this is Condoleezza. What's happening? He's done what? How much? Well, let me know when you've read them. And tell them to hurry. We're not going to hang around here. Damn.
What's happening?
It's the inspection team, sir. They say the Iraq has just handed a whole lot more documents over. It's going to take our guys a while to get through them.
Well, like how long?
About 3 months, sir.
3 months? Geez, doesn't this guy want a war? I'm a patient man. But I got Don and Dick on my tail, and I tell you, their trigger finger's getting kind of itchy. I just want one pretext, one lousy pretext to go after the guy, and he keeps chucking paper at us.
Yeah, well, sir, Resolution 1441 states that he
I know what the resolution states, Condi. God knows we went through it often enough. He has to tell us what he has.
Well, that's what he's doing right now, sir. He's complying.
Yeah, I wish he'd do a little less complying and a little more lying. Doesn't he realize how serious we are? We got a war to fight.
Sir, you know that, and I know that, but we have to do this the right way, or we'll lose the support of the coalition.
I told you, we should have gone with the original wording.
Sir, I'm sorry, but the phrase 98, 99, 100, coming ready or not, did not constitute an acceptable resolution. The Syrians would never have backed it.
So what happened to the gentle art of persuasion? Do you remember the last time when the Yemenis wouldn't back us? What happened? We cut $70 million off their aid budget. Money talks, Condi.
Yeah, but right now, the only ones doing the talking are the Iraqis. And they're going to be talking for quite some while yet.
Has Dr. Blitz found any hard evidence yet?
Not yet, sir.
Didn't he take any in there with him? Whose side is he on, for Christ's sake? This is a crusade, Condi. It's us against them.
Yes. It's the palace inspection team again. He's gone where? Well, do we have a man with him? No, well, fix it. Just do it. It's Saddam. He's gone to the bathroom.
Does that constitute a material breach?
Depends what he has in there.
So, a new year, and our first resolution? To start a war with Iraq. Actually, that's not strictly true, because we haven't finished the last one yet. RAF and American aircraft have been bombing Iraq for over 10 years. Old habits, eh? Last year, Britain alone spent £4 million a week on it, which must really annoy the firefighters. Unless, of course, their second job is servicing our bombers. The signs have been there since December. Troops on standby, reservists called up, Jim Davison told not to take bookings for March. Because there's all sorts of speculation about the timing. People saying that because of the weather, any operation in Iraq has to take place between January and March. At least I think it's that. I overheard a couple talking about it the other day. A man was saying, whatever happens, we absolutely have to be out of there by March. And his wife said, oh, why? Because of Cheltenham.
good morning. Look, we believe Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Now, if we don't attack him, then he might not use them. In which case, we'll never know whether he's got them or not. And, you know, that's not a risk I'm prepared to take. Besides, if we do conquer Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein, there's a chance we could win the Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, frankly, isn't that something worth going to war for?
Of course, we all wish this wasn't the case. It would be great if the week before war begins, the Queen would suddenly remember a conversation she had with Saddam Hussein 5 years ago, when he told her he was looking after all these weapons for safekeeping and had no intention of selling them to anyone. But the fact is, the Americans had 60,000 troops in the region even before the weapons inspectors went in, and plans for invasion were well advanced even before Christmas.
Remind me again why we're invading. Because it is our sacred duty to liberate the population from, what did Jack Straw call it, one of the most vicious and evil regimes in the history of mankind.
Yeah, it's Saddam Hussein, but
Didn't he used to be our ally?
Well, I mean, there was a time when he was a bulwark of stability against the fanatics of Iran, but we've got to forget all about that.
Of course. He's a threat to our oil supplies.
How many times do I have to tell you, Tristram, this has got nothing whatsoever to do with oil?
Sorry, yes. So, this is a historic moment.
Certainly is. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
Remind me again why we're invading.
Yeah, because it is our sacred duty to liberate the population from one of the most vicious and evil regimes in the history of mankind.
Oh, you mean the Turks? Sure. But didn't they used to be our ally?
Well, there was a time, of course, when the Turks were a bulwark of stability against the Russian Empire, but we have to forget about all that.
And of course, they've just discovered oil there, haven't they?
This has nothing whatsoever to do with oil.
Gosh, it's an enormous country.
Yeah, of course, it isn't a country at all, is it? There's a lot of mud and sand and mountains. But we'll make it a country.
We're going to invent a whole new country?
Yes, we often do that in the British Empire. Haven't you ever done it?
No.
Well, now's your chance. It's tremendous fun.
What do you call it? It says here, Mesopotamia.
No, Mesopotamia takes too long to write. No, we need something short and snappy.
Well, anyway, after we've invaded, it'll just be a wreck.
Yeah. What? What did you say?
It'll just be a wreck.
A wreck? I like the sound of that. A wreck.
And so it was that the British put Iraq on the Middle Eastern map. This land where ancient tribes have withstood the passage of time, the boundaries between them shifting and evolving over the centuries. Slowly, the mighty empire of Mesopotamia, its dominions defined over thousands of years, gave way to the mighty Ottoman Empire of the Turks, whose stewardship passed in turn to the custody of the great colonial nations, Britain, France, Russia, each mindful of borders etched over time, careful to respect and refine the delicate patchwork of territories and historic boundaries, aware of how unsettling constant change can be. Mapping out the future, only after the most infinite attention to detail, slowly, subtly, over the course of the century, barely perceptible changes were made to accommodate the indigenous population, each serving to add new shades to a land already rich in colour.
And so Iraq was created by us. The trouble was it had never been a country, just a collection of tribes. Kurds, Marsh Arabs, Shiites, Sunnis, Turkomans, Jews, Assyrians. Mostly they detested each other, so you'd think it would be a tough job for Britain to unite them.
But we did it. Less than 3 years after we took over, they all got together to throw us out. That revolt was put down by British troops, but the Arab tribesmen and the Kurds kept on causing trouble. How do we deal with that? We all know how Saddam Hussein dealt with it 60-odd years later. He bombed the villages.
So what did we do? We bombed the villages. The RAF had a big air base at Habaniya outside Baghdad, from where they sent lumbering Handley Page biplanes to blitz them at the first sign of trouble. In fact, there didn't even need to be any trouble at all before a place was bombed. Perfectly peaceful villages got the treatment if the tribesmen were thought to be too slow paying their taxes.
This was the first systematic bombing of civilians in history. Another gift to a grateful world.
The man behind this policy was the colonial secretary, Winston Churchill.
I look forward to the country being in the condition of an independent native state, friendly to Great Britain, favourable to her commercial interests, and costing hardly any burden on her exchequer.
That last bit was certainly true, as the Iraqis were made to pay for the RAF's operations, and indeed for all British administrative costs in the country. But as for the policy itself, even the Secretary of State for War had his doubts.
If the Arab population realised that the peaceful control of Mesopotamia ultimately depends on our intention of bombing women and children, I am very doubtful if we shall gain that acquiescence of the fathers and husbands of Mesopotamia to which the Secretary of State for the Colonies looks forward.
Now, I know what you're thinking, but Sir Lamming Worthington Evans was actually a real person and a real Secretary of State for War. Though with wishy-washy liberal views like that, it's not surprising he's vanished into history.
But the natives were still pretty uppity, particularly the Kurds.
But I'll tell you this. You know, we have to look after the Kurds in Iraq. Because if we don't look after them over there, then they'll come over here. And I'll tell you, we're not going to look after them over here.
What is it about Kurds? They were still giving trouble to Saddam in the 80s. He gassed them. Where could he have got that idea?
Secret. Dated 29th of March 1919. Gas bombs are required by the 31st Wing for use against recalcitrant Arabs. The suggestion being concurred in by General Staff Baghdad.
At the Air Ministry, Lieutenant Colonel Gossage worried about the effects of gas on the innocent. But those qualms were not shared by the then Secretary of State for War and Air, the future Colonial Secretary, Prime Minister, and greatest Briton of all time.
I do not understand this squeamishness about the use of gas. I am strongly in favour of using poison gas against uncivilized tribes.
Churchill felt that what was required was to arouse in the local population what he called a lively terror. Which is a neat phrase, bearing in mind that we're now busily fighting the war against terror. But there were still worries at the Air Ministry.
I understand that the Secretary of State has approved the general policy of using poisonous gas on uncivilized tribes. So far, although considerable time and trouble was expended on research during the war, we have not yet evolved suitable and practical gas bombs for use from aircraft.
So, there we are. Another good idea goes down the tube. Not because we didn't have the heart, but because we didn't have the technology.
But it does mean that the next time you're asked the question, who was it who first bombed the Kurds? Was it A, the Iranians? Was it B, Saddam Hussein? Was it C, the Turks? Or was it D, Winston Churchill? You won't need to phone a friend. So, now we're about to invade Iraq again. Again. But this time it's different, because this time it's Saddam Hussein.
Mr. President, thank you for joining us. Now, you're currently under great pressure from the United Nations, led by the Americans.
The Americans. Don't talk to me about the Americans. I never know what they want from one minute to the next.
But of course, they say you're the one who's unpredictable.
I'm completely predictable. I will do everything I can to stay in power and fight to make Iraq the most powerful country in the Middle East.
But they've accused you of terrible crimes against your people, of violating the Geneva Protocol on chemical weapons. The US Senate even wanted to punish you for that in the 1980s.
Yes, yes, yes. And who stopped the Senate? The White House, Mr. Reagan. They gave me equipment, they supply information and intelligence from their Saudi AWACS aircraft.
This would be during the Iran-Iraq war?
Yes. There were three of us in that war. So it was a bit crowded, yes.
And you say the Americans were on your side?
Yeah, they even shot down an Iranian airliner. Happy days. Then we find out they were arming the Iranians too. And they say they can't trust me.
But they say that's because you're a brutal dictator, that you torture and kill people.
The Americans, the British, they always know this. But still they give me weapons, they give me credit.
They actually gave you credit.
How do you think I'd buy the weapons? They lend me money? I'm not stupid. Everyone give me weapons. French, Germans, British. 1 year before Gulf War, America sent me helicopter engines, communications equipment, 21 batches of lethal anthrax strains, and hundreds of tons of sarin nerve gas from the Americans. Before I took over Kuwait in 1990, I meet American ambassador. I say, you got a problem with this? She say, we have no opinion on your Arab-Arab conflicts.
Even Kuwait?
Especially Kuwait. They said so, specifically. So I invade Kuwait, and oi gewalt!
All that after they knew you'd used chemical weapons against the Kurds.
Just before I crushed the rebellious Kurds in Halabja, the British even sent their best man.
Their best man?
Well, no, actually, it was David Miller.
Yes, in 1988, David Miller went to discuss trade with Saddam. Shortly afterwards, Saddam killed 5,000 of his own people in a gas attack on Halabja. Shortly after that, Britain approved an extra £340 million of credit, and the Americans lent him another $1 billion. We've been a feature of his life for years.
Hello. This week's guest thought he was spending a quiet night here at home, in one of his many palaces, with his personal food taster, two wives, and the division of the Republican Guard. But let's see if we can surprise him. Saddam Hussein! Saddam Hussein! President, Commander-in-Chief of his armies, this is your right.
The old Teddy Waite knock-knock gag.
Then, in 1979, you called a special meeting of the Iraqi parliament to denounce those you believed betrayed you, and you asked them to step outside.
The plot.
Sadly, none of those ministers asked to leave that day can be with us tonight.
No, because I had them shot.
And rightly so. Nor can your own son-in-law, who you promised to protect on his return to Iraq, having told the world about your secret military arsenal. You shot him too?
No. Oh. No, I had someone else do that.
Excellent. But luckily, there is one person from your past who is still alive. Do you recognize this voice?
Hi there, Saddam. Sorry I can't be with you tonight, but don't worry. We're on our way.
Yes, it's your old friend, U.S. Secretary for Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. Donald, you met Saddam in 1983 to discuss military and economic support for his regime, even though at the time he was launching gas attacks on Iranian soldiers.
No, sorry. Wasn't that a different Saddam?
No, I don't think so.
No. That guy was a key ally, a trusted friend, and a vital force in the battle against Islamic extremism.
No, this is the very same Saddam.
Oh, well, in that case, it was a different Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, unfortunately, Donald Rumpy Pumsfeld cannot be with us tonight. But you have many people who are supporting you across the years. For example, there's Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and of course, George Bush Sr. You thought they were thousands of miles away in the safety of America and Europe, and you are absolutely right.
But let's be clear, we're talking about a country where there's no opposition. As leader, he can ignore Parliament and... Sorry, that's Tony Blair, isn't it? Anyway... So he doesn't even have to ask the country before he goes to war. Sorry, that's still Tony Blair. No, the difference is, Saddam rules Iraq through a combination of terror and brutality, backed up by a vicious regime of intimidation and torture. Or is that David Blunkett? As absolute ruler, Saddam recently claimed 100% victory in a presidential election.
Although that's not surprising, given that voters were accompanied into the booths by Saddam's Ba'ath Party officials, and given a choice between voting for Saddam or voting for their wives and children to be killed and their houses to be burnt down.
And, just a bit of fun, even small children were counted as supporters on the principle that you might as well throw in the baby with the bath voter. Ha-ha!
So, Saddam boasts a kind of total support not enjoyed by a ruler since 1921, when, guess what, the British were around.
80 years ago, the British thought the best way of uniting Iraq, apart from bombing the shit out of it, was to make it a monarchy.
Hmm. What do you think about him? What? Too old? Bit Jewish. Yes. But I like him.
Yeah, Faisal.
Oh, yes, good. Nice beard.
Good beard is vital. And yes. He is UK friendly, decent family, a descendant of the Prophet, apparently, always goes down well with the camel shaggers.
Hang on, when we captured Damascus in 1918, didn't we make him king of Syria?
Yes, we did. We did, yes. But when they carved out the Middle East with the French, they threw him out.
Oh, so he's free?
Yes, he's between thrones, as it were. He'll be ideal. Of course, we shall have to hold some sort of plebiscite to make sure he's accepted by the population.
Well, that's a bit risky, isn't it? I mean, what if there's another candidate? The Nationalists have got this chap Saeed Taleb. What do we do about him?
Well, we mustn't be heavy-handed.
No, absolutely not.
Why don't we kidnap him and send him off to Ceylon?
Yes, good work, yes. What do you think the result of the plebiscite should be? Faisal gets 99% of the vote?
A bit high.
95%?
A bit low.
Let's split the difference. 96.8%.
Done.
So when Saddam held an election with no opposition candidate, he was going back to a tradition of 80 years ago, just like bombing the Kurds. This is what Tony Blair would call traditional values in a modern context.
But despite us giving them a king, despite us granting them independence in 1932, by 1941 the locals had become so unreliable there was only one thing for it. We had to invade. Again.
We were getting good at this. The oil flowed. The king was on his throne. There was peace, a stable, pro-Western government, everything we'd always wanted.
Okay, thank you. There's been a popular revolution.
Popular with who?
Not with me, certainly. They've murdered the king, the crown prince, the prime minister, the deputy prime minister, the defence minister, and they've burned down the British embassy.
You see, Tristram, it's always the same. We give them a royal family, we send their kings to Harrow, we build them hospitals, schools and roads.
We bomb them and gas them.
Nothing's too much trouble. And this is the thanks we get.
Well, I suppose we'll just have to bomb them again.
Well, that would be lovely, Tristram, but unfortunately we closed the RAF base 2 years ago.
Oh, well. Well, that means another invasion then. We are getting quite good at that.
If we know one thing at the Foreign Office, Tristram, it is how to draw lessons from history. And you can take it from me that whatever else happens, we are not going to set foot in that ghastly country again.
Back in 2003, the pretext for war is that in defiance of UN resolutions, Saddam Hussein has been developing weapons of mass destruction. And as George W. Bush said, we cannot have a situation where the world's worst leaders are in charge of the world's most powerful weapons.
Since the end of World War II, the Americans have spent $19 trillion on what they call defense, which they spell differently and define very differently. If you were to spend $26 million every day since the birth of Christ, you'd have spent less than the Americans have spent on defense since the end of the Second World War.
So that's the most powerful weapons sorted out. Now we're just arguing about the worst leader bit.
So does Saddam have these weapons? We know he used to have enough to kill the world's population four times over. We know that because we sold him quite a lot of it. The last team of UN inspectors claimed they destroyed 95% of Saddam's weapons.
During those inspections, Saddam used every trick in the book, including moving biological weapons material around in a fleet of red and white vans on which he'd painted Tip Top Ice Cream Company.
I'll have two 99s, a botulism ripple and a smallpox wafer.
So, how much of a threat is he? Well, one sure way of finding out is to attack him first and see what happens. So, Foreign Secretary, what's the threat? It's very, very important. I just want to make this perfectly clear. It's very, very important. The greatest threat is if these weapons, which we believe he has, fall into terrorist hands. Yes. What evidence do you have of that? Sorry, can I just make this point? It's very, very important. Very important point. None.
That even applies to September the 11th, 2001. That day, Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked airliners and crashed them into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. 1 year later, George W. Bush hijacked the anniversary to link Al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein when the two have no proven connection.
Bin Laden and Saddam Hussein are like Nancy DeLolio and Ulrika Johnson. They can't stand each other, they just like f***ing the same bloke.
So what do you do when you've got a Saudi-born terrorist launching attacks on Yemen, America, Indonesia and Kenya? Well, that's obvious. You invade Iraq. But why now? Well, just as the world changed dramatically on September the 11th, 2001, so America changed dramatically in November 2000.
Then a small group of people with Middle Eastern connections, determined to impose their brand of fundamentalism on the rest of the population, launched a dramatic assault on the White House.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States. So help me God.
Tony Blair maintains that whenever they're given the chance, people all around the world embrace the values we share in the West. Even now, there are people in Iraq hoping the bombs will stop falling on their heads so they can rush out and buy shares in BP. So who are these new crusaders? Are they all like Congressman John Cooksey, looking for, quote, with a diaper on his head and a fan belt around that diaper? And what values do they bring? Well, the values of the new America. Democracy, George Bush style. No more 100% victories, but a new system where there are two candidates and the one with the most votes loses. Freedom under the rule of law from the administration that's ignoring or refusing to sign a whole list of international treaties.
Justice from the people who gave you Guantanamo Bay. And economic strength from the people who brought you Enron.
We all know the big guys, the guys who make things happen in life. But behind every big guy, there's someone else. Someone even more special. A really big guy. Guys who make the wheels turn in this great country of ours. Meet Thomas White, former vice chairman of Enron Energy Services. While he was in the job, Enron rigged and exploited California's electricity market, causing chaos, power cuts, and unemployment, and what the Senate investigator called a mob-style protection racket. He doesn't work there anymore. He's now Secretary of the U.S. Army. Meet Larry Thompson. He headed up the Audit and Compliance Committee of Providian. This insurance firm was forced to pay $400 million in fines and compensation after swindling its investors, the frail and elderly, of most of their savings. Larry later faced personal claims of insider trading after selling $4 million of Providian stock just before the share price dropped. But he doesn't work there anymore. He's now George Bush's fraud buster, charged with restoring faith in American business ethics. And meet Dick Cheney, head of the Republican Committee to find a vice presidential candidate. He found himself. He sold $30 million of his shares as chief executive in engineering company Halliburton after accounting changes allegedly inflated the share price by $234 million. The shares later collapsed and Halliburton are now under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's thanks to men like Tom, Dick, and Larry that the biggest of the big guys, our great leader, George W. Bush, can stand proud and say,
"We should be able to punish corporate leaders who are convicted of abusing their powers by banning them from ever serving again as officers or directors of a publicly held corporation."
George Bush. And he should know, because he's been arrested 3 times for different offenses and only got off an $800,000 oil shares trading charge when the investigator, appointed by his father, said there was insufficient evidence to proceed. God bless you, America, and God bless men like this who do so much to truly make our nation what it is today.
But there's a huge opportunity here. If George Bush is serious about bringing down Saddam, he shouldn't send in the military. He should send in teams of American accountants. These guys are used to running utilities like Enron. Even the British could help with people like George Simpson. In his last year in charge of Marconi, one of our biggest defence suppliers, the company's value crashed from nearly £35 billion to under £1.5 billion. That's the kind of guy we need. He could destroy Iraq's weapons capability in 2 years. You think I'm joking? 20 years ago, who was the biggest threat to world peace? The Soviet Union. Then Gorbachev woke up one morning and thought, "Oh, let's try capitalism." And they're buggered for a generation. They're no threat to anyone. They're too busy setting up McDonald's and Starbucks. And Iraq's a whole new market. Imagine the possibilities. New outlets everywhere. Burger King. Donna Karan. Bars selling Mullah Light. Of course, that wouldn't exactly have them dancing in the caves of Tora Bora.
Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah, Rubul Lailamin. Akhiran sof in Hezim Adu Uneludut, Walenu Hediduna Bad El En. Falatale, Bahalimne, Bekaharihi, Watinmirihi, Kimahale, who have been cochre,
Watinmirihi.
Tadamurat Aslehatuhu, Wasamatut Medifiahu, Wasbala, Bile Holin, Welakuachin.
God damn.
Dawal el hetat eledi ahata vehi nefsahu. Kadin sahaka what effect hete kram le sahara. Alhamdu ashukru lile suhana.
Who's the guy on the left? Is that Mullah Omar?
That's the one, sir.
Sesumu mahu filirati el rabahi.
Is this tape genuine, or is it one of ours?
Oh, it's genuine.
What do you do with a guy like that? If he hates us that much, ain't nothing gonna stop him attacking us again, right?
Yes, sir. There is one difference, though, sir.
What's that?
It's not us he was talking about.
So who's he talking about?
He's talking about Saddam Hussein.
Osama hates Saddam Hussein? Mm-hmm. How come?
Sir, Saddam Hussein is a secular ruler. Bin Laden wants an Islamic state run under Sharia law. They're enemies.
Do the people know this?
Sir, people know what we tell them. And right now, if we're talking about a war against terror, it suits us just fine if folks think that Saddam and Al-Qaeda are in each other's pockets.
It's the best argument we got, Condi.
It's the only argument we got.
So if Osama hates Saddam, hell, he should be on our side. He could do the job for us.
That's what he wanted to do, sir. When Saddam invaded Kuwait, Osama wanted to get his guys in there and wipe him out.
Could he have done that?
He'd been well trained, sir.
Oh, ho, ho. You mean by us?
You bet. Back in the 80s, Osama was one of the best guys we had, fighting the Russians in Afghanistan.
Oh, the Russians. Now, there was a real enemy. At least you knew where they were.
Right.
Yeah. That's what these folk have got to understand. What goes around, comes around. So how come Osama didn't take out Saddam 12 years ago?
The Saudis wouldn't let him, sir.
The Saudis wouldn't let him?
No, sir. They got someone else to do it instead.
Well, whoever it was, he obviously didn't do a very good job. Who was this guy?
It'd be your father, sir.
To be fair on George W., it wasn't just his father. It was the people around him, guys like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. These are the guys pushing the war policy. They're like Fred Truman and Ray Illingworth, grumbling into their beards. If you ask me, I don't know why we don't just go in there and take him out.
But when they did ask him, why didn't he take out Saddam 12 years ago? Dick Cheney said,
I think if we had done that, we would have been bogged down there for a very long period of time with a real possibility we might not have succeeded. And then you've got to worry about what comes after. You're going to take a lot more casualties if you're going to muck around in Iraq for weeks on end trying to run Saddam to the ground and capture Baghdad and so forth. And I don't think it would have been worth it.
I wonder where he is now.
People say it's about oil, but it can't be. It can't be about oil. George W. Bush says it's not about oil. Dick Cheney says it's not about oil. And these people should know.
Bush, George W. Founder of oil company Arbusto Energy, former shareholder oil company Spectrum 7 Energy, former director Harkin Oil and Gas, son of oil magnate George H.W. Bush. Cheney, Richard Dick. Former CEO, oil company Halliburton Industries. Customers included Unocal, Exxon, Shell, and Chevron. Plus Saddam Hussein, Colonel Gaddafi, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Rice, Condoleezza. Former director of oil company Chevron. Chevron are partners in a massive New Caspian oil venture, had 129,000-ton oil tanker named after her.
It's a great thought, isn't it, that Condoleezza Rice is actually an oil tanker. That explains why she takes so long to change her mind, because she's got to keep going in one direction for 6 miles before she can actually turn around. So, to recap, we may or may not be going to war with Iraq because Saddam may or may not have weapons of mass destruction, which he may or may not use or pass to other terrorist groups with whom he may or may not have links. George Tenet, the CIA director, reckons Al-Qaeda exists in 60 countries. George Bush's reaction? Let's pick them off one at a time.
Saddam's not alone in developing illegal weapons. So do India and Pakistan, and we're not about to attack them. Ah, yes, you say. But Saddam has illegal weapons of mass destruction, and he's invaded other countries, and he has a load of UN resolutions against him, which is true too. But then so has Israel, and we're not about to attack them, or North Korea, or Iran, or Libya, or Saudi Arabia, which is, after all, where Bin Laden came from, which has appalling human rights records and no democracy. Still, you've got to start somewhere. So it might as well be Iraq.
Can we win? Well, of course, given American arms superiority. Although the results of a huge planning exercise were interesting. In July and August this year, in the biggest war game of all time, the $250 million Millennium Challenge 2002, the combined might of the American armed forces took on what was called a militarily powerful Middle Eastern nation on the Persian Gulf, ruled by a crazy but cunning megalomaniac. I wonder who that could be. The part of the enemy was played by retired Marine Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper. Using a flotilla of civilian ships and planes and messages broadcast from the minarets of mosques, he'd succeeded in sinking 16 American ships and wiping out thousands of Marines before the Americans decided they wanted their ball back. The Pentagon then simply ordered all the dead troops back to life and refloated their sunken ships. The referees then told Van Riper his communications had been destroyed, ordered him to turn off his air defences whenever the Americans were about to attack, and move his forces away from areas where the Americans wanted to land. Not surprisingly, Van Riper gave up and refused to play anymore. But luckily, for the real thing, the Americans have the might of the British Army.
George Parr, you're a senior planner at the Ministry of Defence.
I am, yes.
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 And you must be very preoccupied at the moment with the possible war against Iraq.
We're thrilled. We're thrilled. We're looking forward to it tremendously. Of course, it's what we do, war. Defence is the name, attack is the game, that's our motto.
Yes. So you must be feverishly making preparations at the moment.
Oh, yeah, we are, because it's, of course, it's our job to make sure that our soldiers have got the best possible equipment.
Yes.
And it's fine-tuned to a peak of perfection, and we've been working tremendously hard on that. Last year, for example, we had a huge military exercise. In fact, the biggest deployment of British troops since the Gulf War in the Persian Gulf in Oman.
In Oman?
Yes.
Yes, of course, yes. This was Operation Swift Sword.
That's right, exactly,
wasn't it?
Yes.
And did you choose Oman because the terrain and the climate were very similar to Iraq?
Yes, it's very close to Iraq, of course,
yes,
and
yes.
It was tremendously useful from that,
yes.
That point.
And was the operation a success?
Tremendous success, yes. Yes. We learned an enormous amount. Mm.
Such as?
Well, we learned never to get into one of our helicopters. Our helicopters are, of course, designed for operations in Northern Europe.
Of course, yes.
And under those conditions, normal European conditions, the rotor blades, you know, things that go around, keep it up, they have a life expectancy of about 500 hours. Now, we found in Oman, in desert conditions, this was somewhat reduced.
Reduced to what?
27 hours.
Did this come as a surprise?
It did to the pilots.
Yes.
And we also had similar problems with the Challengers.
Well, the Challenger tank, this is the British Army's main battle tank.
Main battle tank, yes, and a very, very formidable weapon, particularly mm-hmm. when it's able to move about.
Was it not able to move about in Oman?
One of the most interesting things that we discovered out there in Oman was that in the deserts of the Middle East, you can at times get large quantities of sand.
And I believe you often do.
Do you? Yes. Well, certainly our experience supports that theory. And what happens is that the sand, you see, gets into the air filters of the Challenger tanks mm-hmm. and clogs them up. Now,
yes.
Of course, the Challenger tank is designed for operations in Northern Europe. Mm. And under those conditions, an air filter would be expected to last about a year.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, in the desert, this was slightly reduced.
To what?
4 hours.
So you couldn't use the tank?
No, not for shooting at people and moving about. No, it's a small cocktail party, that sort of thing. But
apart from the prevalence of sand, the heat is another thing that you get in the deserts of the Middle East. In fact, some of our older vehicles, the engines got so hot that the only way to keep them running was to turn on the heaters in the cabs, full on. But then the drivers got so hot they had to get out every few minutes.
Doesn't sound very efficient.
Well, no, but you have to remember that these vehicles were designed for operations in Northern Europe.
Yes. And of course you had other problems with the Armour's Assault Rifle, rather well-publicised problems with the sand and the dust getting into the mechanism and jamming the gun.
Yes. Of course there has been some very unfortunate negative publicity about this gun. AS-80A2 is standard issue British rifle. It's a lethal weapon, particularly to anybody trying to fire it. It is completely reliable, provided you take elementary precautions. If every time you fire it, you take it apart and oil it.
Of course, in the middle of the battle, there wouldn't really be time to do that.
Oh, you have to find time. You have to find time. It's for boredom, you see. But you see, the soldiers don't like, you know, the desert. It's very, very hot, and the sand, and and we found that even the uniforms are too heavy, the tents were too hot, and in Oman, the soldiers' boots melted.
What did you do about that?
Well, we didn't do everything, because we were at home planning. But what they did was some of the soldiers could locally buy their own boots, you know.
You're making this up, aren't you?
No, everything I'm telling you is actually factually true.
Excuse me, General, but it does seem to me that the British Army seems rather ill-equipped to fight a battle in the Middle East, because your battle communication system, what's that called?
The ptarmigan.
Yeah. Now, that didn't work in Oman, did it?
No, that's very misleading to say that, very misleading. It is true, it doesn't work in the desert. But it doesn't work anywhere else either. So.
Yes, because I remember that in Kosovo, soldiers were reduced to relying on their own mobile phones to contact other units, weren't they?
Yes, they were. We couldn't do that in Oman because there isn't the coverage. And
presumably there wouldn't be in Iraq either.
Oh, we don't know. It is possible that Saddam Hussein, as well as building up his chemical, biological and nuclear capability, is also developing a mobile phone network. It would be useful if one of our tank commanders, very useful if he could get out of his tank, get on his mobile, and say, my tank has seized up, the rotor blades have fallen off the helicopter, the gun has caught fire, my rifle is jammed, and my boots are melting, I await further instructions. And he can send a little picture of himself doing it.
That's true. So what would you say was the greatest lesson that you learnt in Oman?
It's blindingly obvious, really. If we are to mount a successful military campaign against Saddam Hussein, we must, at all costs, we must get him to come and fight us in Northern Europe. You see, because then all our equipment would work, and there'd be a political dividend too, you see, because the moment he invaded Poland, everybody would agree to attack him, you see.
It's true, but if for some reason he can't be persuaded to invade Poland...
Yes. Worst case scenario. Yes.
And the war actually takes place in Iraq, and it's just ourselves and the Americans. It's hard to see what sort of military support we'll be able to offer the Americans.
Well, to be quite frank, I don't think the Americans are all that bothered about our military support. They can do all that side of it themselves, really.
So what is it that they want from us?
From us? Dead bodies, I think, is what they want. You see, I think if a war does occur in Iraq, it's very important for Washington that not all the bodies in the body bags will be American.
So this is what's been called the blood sacrifice.
No, exactly. Tony Blair's exact words, the blood sacrifice. Yes, I know. Tony Blair himself said, what matters is that we stand up and be counted.
Or in our case, fall down.
Fall down and be counted.
General, thank you very much indeed.
It's a great pleasure.
Thank you.
And if you do get the put down, then what? Well, it paves the way for the country to be governed by any one or all of the numerous opposition parties who hate each other only slightly less than they hate Saddam.
But there's no one candidate. Last summer, Dick Cheney auditioned opposition leaders by video link from his holiday home in Wyoming. It must have been a bit like Blind Date.
Hello, guys. You have 11% of the world's oil resources. How much of that are you prepared to sell to me at preferential rates? And I'll put that one to number one.
Of course, the best solution will be to have another proper king. Or any kind of king.
A gift on your wedding day from the Sultan of Brunei. Kosher, too. What do you think, Grayson? You know a bit about this sort of stuff. 30 quid, Tewkesbury car boot sale. And the council won't take it. Don't know these things. Get caught with a load of your booty, we'd end up in Chokey. 500 years ago, it would be me slinging him in there. Look at that, 3 degrees. Oh, look, signed. By Spike Milligan. It's probably worth a bob or two. That was when I was somebody. Not anymore. Bloody butlers finished us all off. I'm off where I'm wanted. A king at last. All right, so there might not be a branch of Gives in Baghdad. No place to service the Aston, but after a lifetime of military dictatorship, I should be bloody glad if the worst they're asked to do is to put a dob of Colgate on the old royal toothbrush every day. Do you know, in many ways, my life's been a sort of preparation for this moment. I can read the Quran without people sniggering. I could marry Camilla. Maybe all those wonderful palaces to choose from. It'd be fantastic. Goodbye, Highgrove. Goodbye, potting shed. Goodbye, Mum and Dad. Salam alaikum. Here I come.
Well, why not? It's practical, it continues a pattern, it solves a problem for us too. Prince Andrew could have Jordan. He's always fancied her. And it's in our interests, which has always been the most important consideration.
Look, I know people worry about the possibility of war. I worry about it too. But I think what people have got to understand is I'm passionate about this. Just as I'm passionate about poverty and education and Africa and crime. Yes, of course, crime. But what I say to you is simply this. If we can disarm Saddam and bring peace and security to the Middle East, if we can bring a lasting solution to the people of Israel and Palestine, in that order, let's not forget, if we can remove from positions of power those who threaten their people and those in other countries, if we can bring peace to the world and decency and justice and an end to famine and conflict, all within our own prudently costed financial limits for the coming year, then I say to you, then, and only then, will I be able to turn to our public sector workers and say, look, I'm sorry, what was it you wanted?
In the end, it comes down to wanting to get rid of one man. And although our weapons have got infinitely more sophisticated, it's not clear if we have, as we seem to believe the best way of removing Saddam is by bombing as many of his countrymen as we have to until we get to him. And as the man said 80 years ago,
if the Arab population realize that the peaceful control of Mesopotamia ultimately depends on our intention of bombing women and children, I am very doubtful if we shall gain that acquiescence of the fathers and husbands of Mesopotamia to which the Secretary of State for the Colonies looks forward.